help me to welcome Peg R. from Cornelius, North Carolina.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Peg, and I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Groups. I'm glad you're all here this morning. I'm glad that I'm here this morning. I want to say thank you to everyone who made it possible for me to be here, for my husband and I to be here. It's always a privilege to participate in this way, in a meeting of recovery. One time when Mike had spoken, someone came up to me after the meeting and said, "You must really love him to have stayed with him through all of that." And I looked at her and thought, well, no, I was just real sick. And that is the truth. Sometimes people expect me to come up here and talk a lot about my side of Mike's story, and the truth is I've got enough of my own disease that I don't need to talk about Mike a lot. But today, I do love him, but I am only able to say that because I learned about love in the rooms of Al-Anon and in the rooms of AA. I didn't know how to love. I didn't know what love was. I didn't know how to let you love me, and I certainly didn't know how to share any kind of love with you for most of my life before I walked into the rooms of recovery. I will talk about some things today that I'm not proud of, but I'm not ashamed of them anymore. And I share the things that I share up here because I don't know who out there needs to hear that I've been where they are, that I've felt the things that they've felt and done some of the things that they've done. I have learned from going to a lot of AA speaker meetings that I believe we all have alcoholism. A good friend of mine, Virginia, says this, that we all have alcoholism. Some of us drink at it and some of us do other things at it. But what's inside us is the same thing. I believe that. I hear that when you speak to me, and I hope you'll hear some of that today as I share my story. I've been attending Al-Anon since August 17th, 1993. My home group, well, it's kind of up in the air right now. I've probably got about three home groups, but New Awakenings family group on Sunday mornings in Charlotte is my home group and has been for those 8.5 years. It was the first meeting that I walked into where I felt at home, where I felt welcome. I felt loved. And I had not felt those things in a long time. I had not felt comfortable anywhere for a long time. Jan mentioned that she's a low, Kay mentioned that she's a low-bottom drunk, and I think I'm a low-bottom Al-Anon. Because it took a lot of drunks in my life to get me into these rooms. When I was growing up, we didn't talk about alcoholism, but we talked about having a lot of people in our family who were bad to drink. My father was bad to drink. I had two uncles who were bad to drink, one of whom died living on the street as a result of his alcoholism. One of whom died when I was 13 from blowing his brains out as a direct result of his alcoholism. I've had a stepfather who was bad to drink because my mother was a slow learner too. I've had two fathers-in-law who were bad to drink. And you know from listening to Mike last night, I had one who didn't drink at all, so that you can count that up right there. That probably tells you I need to be here. And I've had a couple of husbands who were bad to drink. I had one husband who was an untreated member of Al-Anon, and I will tell you that he was the sickest of the bunch. So I qualify. I need to be here. I should have gotten here a long time ago, but it took what it took. What have realized over the years in looking at my life is that I learned how to live life by watching alcoholics and the people who were affected by their disease. I learned who to be who I am today by watching alcoholics. And that didn't turn out to be the best role models in the world. Today I don't blame those people. They were sharing with me all they had to share with me. They were doing the very best that they could just to survive with their disease, as I have had to do as well. But I learned how to grow up and be an adult from watching these people. I learned from my father, for example, that honesty is optional. If being honest is going to get you in trouble, there's probably a better way. There's another story you can use. I learned that from watching him when we would go into the bars on Saturday night, and my parents took us with them when they went and drank in bars. Now, my husband tells me that's not normal. I didn't know that. I thought it was. But I would watch him drink and run up the tab and walk out on the tab and do it intentionally. So I learned that honesty is, sometimes it might be the best policy, sometimes it might not. I learned from watching my mother that if you drink with them, things go a little smoother. She drank with my father. Unfortunately, she was not a professional, and she's the one who got in trouble with her drinking. She's the one who got hauled off for hit and run. She hit another car that was parked on the side of the road when she was drinking one night. She was driving because, of course, she was in better shape. She wasn't the alcoholic. She was in better shape to do it, but she wasn't professional enough to know how to do it and get away with it. But I learned from watching that if you drink with them, things go more smoothly. When you don't drink with them, there's probably going to be a lot of fighting and a lot of unpleasantness. I learned from growing up in that family that whatever is going on with you, however bad it is, however painful it is, just don't talk about it. Just pretend it's not there, and maybe it'll go away. I know today we call that denial, but I didn't know that then. I thought then that was just the best way to cope with your problems, because there were a lot of things that went on in our home that we just pretended weren't there. I learned from being in that family that the one person I could depend on to take care of me was myself. Nobody else was going to be the grown-up in the house, and I was going to be the grown-up. And I did that very well. I did that very well. I can remember the best example that I have of that is when we were small. Sometimes when they didn't take us to the bars with them on Saturday night, they would drop us off at the neighborhood theater, my little sister and me, and drop us off for the double feature. In those days, you could go see the double feature for a quarter, and you could buy a candy bar and an all-day sucker for a nickel, and you were set. It was a great babysitter. And we would sit there and watch the double feature. And as the second movie started coming to an end, and I was 8, 9, about that age at this time. My sister was 3 years younger. As the double feature started coming to an end, I would begin anticipating that it was time for my parents to be there. It was time for them to come pick us up, and anticipating that they would not be there. And most of the time they weren't. Now, I don't think they did this to be mean. I don't think they did this to neglect us. I don't think they had any idea that we were doing anything except sitting there like a couple of kids enjoying a movie and an all-day supper. But I would start anticipating what was going to happen if they didn't show up. What was I going to do with my little sister if they closed the theater and my parents weren't there yet? This theater was on the main drag in our neighborhood, A couple of miles down the road was a hospital, and invariably it seemed that two or three ambulances would roar by while the movie was going on, and I would listen to that and wonder if this was the time maybe that that ambulance had my parents in it. And I would sit there in fear, wondering what was going to happen. And they would finally arrive, and they would be drunk, and we would go home. And nothing was ever said, and I lived with that fear. But I knew as I sat there in the theater that the only person I could depend on to take care of me if they did not show up was me. And I was going to have to take care of me and my sister. Fortunately, that never happened. But I learned to live with that fear, and I learned to live with that certainty that I was the one in charge. I learned in growing up with that family, I think as a result of that, that I was the only higher power that I needed. I did not have a relationship with God, and I didn't want a relationship with God. I could be my own higher power. I also learned in that family that I was not as good as you. I knew that there was something wrong with my family. I knew we weren't like the other families or the other kids in the neighborhood and the other kids I went to school with. And I knew that we weren't as good. And I worked really hard, especially in my childhood, to look better than you looked on the outside so that you would never know that underneath I was not as good as you. So I worked really hard, made good grades, tried really hard to do all the right things so that you'd never know who I really was and what kind of home I was growing up in. I also learned in that family to rage. I realize now that the only way I knew at that point, the only way I was able at that point to release any kind of emotion was to be a rager. And I can remember when I was 11 or 12, the power went off one night, and there was a TV show that I really had been counting on watching, and the power went out, and I wasn't going to be able to watch it. Now, that's not a big deal. That's really not a big deal. But what I did, my response to that was to become so enraged that I kicked a hole in the wall in our home. That's not normal either, but I didn't know that then. And I became a teenager. I already knew, as I said, that I wasn't as good as you, but it was real important for me not to let you know that. And one of the ways that I set out to do that was by attaching myself to someone that I thought was going to make me look really good. And I spotted this guy at church, and he was the guy that all the grandmothers wanted their granddaughters to date. You know, he looked really good. He always came to church in a little suit, and he wore glasses, and he looked very distinguished. He was 3 years older than me, so, you know, very distinguished fellow. And I thought, you know, if I'm going out with him, if I'm on his arm, then you're going to think I'm okay. You're going to think I'm pretty good. And I set out to get him. And unfortunately, I did. And it was a very unhealthy relationship. It was physically and emotionally abusive. And I was still in high school at the time, and I managed to hide that from everyone that I knew. But I stayed in that relationship because I thought it was all I deserved. I thought it was the best that I could do. And I didn't know that I didn't have to live that way. I married that young man when I was barely 18. I remember walking down the aisle thinking, someday I will be strong enough to get out of this. But I was not at that time. I was afraid to do anything except walk down that aisle and say, I do. He went off to Vietnam, didn't die, he came back. I went to college. And in the years that I was in college, I did begin to get a little stronger. With him out of my life for a while, I began to get a little bit stronger. And by the time he returned, I was able to walk out of that marriage. So by the time I'm 21, I've already been married and divorced. And took my first geographic cure. I moved from Birmingham, Alabama, where I was born and grew up, to Tallahassee, Florida. I was about a semester away from being finished with college at that point, but it seemed a lot more important to me just to get out of town. So I left that college, left that town, and moved to Tallahassee, Florida. It took a while, but I did finish, not 25 years, but I did finish college. And one of the things that had happened before I got out of that marriage was that I took my first drink. And I took that first drink because everybody that he and I associated with drank. His father was an alcoholic. He didn't drink either. But everybody that we associated with drank. And they drank to excess. Because to both of us, that looked normal. And one night, his best friend said to me, "Oh, come on, have a drink." So I had a drink. And what I learned was that if I had a couple of drinks, my mother had already taught me this, if I had a couple of drinks, I was comfortable being around people who drank. And I drank myself and used drugs for the next at least 10 or 12 years, and did it to excess in those years. And I have talked to other women in Al-Anon who say they did the same thing, and it was a good self-protective device. It was a good way to feel comfortable and not be terrified of what was going to happen next when you were surrounded by people who were drunk. I did that. Fortunately for me, I never crossed that line, but I know I could. I know I could at any time because alcohol runs in my family. And so long before we ever got into the rooms of recovery, I quit drinking, and it didn't cause me any problems to quit drinking. My only problems at that point were the people in my life who wouldn't quit drinking. But I know today I could still cross that line at any time, so I still choose not to drink. And I, of course, choose not to drug either. But I did that for a lot of years because it was one more of those things that I had to do to try to feel better. The truth about me is that everything I've ever done in my life, I've had to do to excess in order to feel okay, in order to feel like I was all right. And so I drank to excess, and I used relationships to excess. I worked addictively for years. I worked in a career where, I worked 10 and 12-hour days. And I used to exercise to excess. I was a jogger for years. I started jogging back before most of the rest of the world was doing that. And I remember the day that I ran 11 miles and didn't want to stop. And I thought, this just isn't working anymore. And everything that I did like that in order to feel better, eventually it just quit working for me. And eventually the relationships quit working for me as well. But all of it was just an attempt to feel okay about myself. And I realize as I look at all of that how blessed I was not to have become an alcoholic. Because I think if there had been two of us in our home, one of us would probably be dead today. So I moved to Tallahassee, and I was in that phase of my life where I was doing a lot of partying, and I ended up graduating from college and started my career, went into a career that is filled with alcoholics. I went into journalism, and the first time I walked into a newsroom, I just felt right at home. And I know it was because there were a lot of people in that room who used drugs and alcohol, and it was a part of their life, and I felt real at home there. And in that first newsroom, I met my second husband, and he was bad to drink. And although we had a good relationship and he was a good man, I didn't have the maturity to make that relationship work. I didn't have the maturity to be able to communicate with him. I didn't have the ability to give any love, and I didn't have the ability to receive his love. All I could do at that point in my life was go out there and do whatever I had to do to feel better about myself. At that point in my life, I was still out there raging. I was out there being very difficult to deal with. I can remember, and Mike has told me this because we worked in the same place for a while. The people that I worked with took a lot of abuse from me. And I can remember there was a cartoonist who worked for us, and I always wanted him to be a different kind of cartoonist than he was. I wanted stuff that looked like this, and he did things that looked like this. And I would go and berate him to change his style of art, which is insane, I realize today, but I didn't know it at that time. And I would go to him and get on his case and berate him. And I walked out of that newsroom one day, and he turned to the rest of the newsroom and shook his head, and Mike has told me this, shook his head and said, "Man, how'd you like to have to be married to that?" And that's who I was. I was not an easy person to live with. I got out of that second marriage and was blessed at that time to find someone who made me whole. He made everything okay. He taught me a lot about love. He taught me a lot about being calm. He taught me a lot about how not to live in my anger anymore. He made me think that everything was going to be okay. I met Mike, and he was a gentle, soft-spoken, kind-hearted person. And I thought, this man is never going to hurt me. And we were married. And for a long time, we had a wonderful relationship in those early years. And then something started to change. Something started to shift. And I didn't really understand what it was for a long time. I just knew that I was getting fearful again. I just knew that things didn't feel right. I just knew that when he was gone all day playing golf, that I would stand in the upstairs window waiting for him, wondering when he was going to get back and what was going to happen when he got back. And I started feeling like that little girl sitting in that neighborhood theater, wondering when, what, how. But I didn't realize that it was alcohol. I couldn't see it because alcoholism looked so normal to me that it never occurred to me that that's what was going on. My life began to fall apart, and I couldn't understand why. He told me that the problem was alcoholism. I couldn't see it. He tried for several years to get sober, and our life continued to spiral downward. My mother was very sick at that time. She had cancer for 4 years before she died, and being the person that I was, I tried really hard to manage and control that disease, and it consumed my life, and I made her miserable, and I made Mike miserable, and I made myself miserable. But it was all I knew to do. Was to try to control this thing, try to make it work out the way I knew it ought to work out, And of course it didn't. But I blamed what was happening in our family on my mother's cancer. And I thought that when she died, it would all be okay. I also thought, actually, though, about 6 months before she died, I thought, you know, if this is who he is, when my mother dies, this is over. This is over. I won't live like this. But I knew I didn't have the energy to deal with it right then. And what I believe about that today is that God used my mother's disease to break me so that I would be ready to receive the great gift that you people offered, because I was a hard case and I would not have been remotely interested in anything you people had to say to me until I was broken and on my knees. And I think my mother's illness, which went on for so long and took so much out of me and everyone else, was a part of allowing me to be broken so that I would be receptive to recovery. She died. Life did not get back to normal. Life got worse. And you've already heard that I was away in business when Mike decided it was time for him to get sober. But at that point, I was crazy. I was insane. My days were consumed with trying to figure out what he was doing so that I could make him stop. I just thought if I could find out the truth of the day, then I could fix things. And it never worked, but I continued to believe it. And they tell me today that insanity is doing the same things over and over again, expecting different results. And I did that for years in that marriage. He did get sober. He started going to AA. When I came home that night and he was reading that big book, I really was not happy about that. He had said to me at one point, if nothing else works, I'll go to AA. As you see, nothing else did work, but I had no confidence whatsoever in AA. The big book that he was reading actually belonged to me. And I had read these steps. And I don't know if you've noticed or not, but these steps really don't tell me much about what to do to make somebody quit drinking. So I had no confidence at all that this recovery business was going to help. So I wasn't happy to see him doing that. It just looked like one more dodge to me. But he went. The first meeting he went to, I rode with him and I waited in the car. I was sick. What can I tell you? I waited for him in the car. And I was numb at that point. I was numb. I felt like my life was just in pieces at my feet. And I couldn't see a way to put it back together. After he'd been sober, well, after he'd been in the rooms a couple of weeks, we went on vacation with his daughter and a friend of hers. We went to the Outer Banks, which is an all-day drive from the Charlotte area. And the whole trip back, I spent the trip trying to figure out whether to kill myself, kill somebody else, whether to try to get away with it if I kill somebody else, or whether to just say, I did it, I'm crazy, and see what happened. You know, I had pretty much decided that prison was not going to be that bad. It couldn't be any worse than what I was living in. And Mike sat down with me that night and told me that I needed help, that I needed to go to Al-Anon. Well, I did not want to go to Al-Anon. I did not need your help. I could not imagine. I could imagine. I could imagine this room with all these touchy-feely women sitting around talking about their feelings, and there was nothing that was going to go on there that was going to help me. I knew that, and that was just not my kind of thing. Now, I used to think of myself as strong, but I realize now there's a difference between being strong and being tough, and I was just tough that time. So I didn't need you, but the truth is, I didn't know what else to do. And I was watching him, and he was getting better. Now, that really ticked me off. And he was getting better, and I was just getting sicker. I think the better he got, the sicker I got. So, the Monday after we got back from the Outer Banks, I picked up the phone and called the Al-Anon office, and we're blessed in the Charlotte area to have an office, and it's staffed with volunteers. And I went down there and walked in, and there was a wonderful woman there, and I'll never forget her. And she had a box of Kleenex, and I have no idea what she said to me. I have no idea what I said to her. But I started crying, and she told me it was going to be okay, and she told me where to go to a meeting, and she gave me some literature. And I walked out of there, and the next morning I went to a meeting, and they had a newcomers meeting. And I'll never forget the woman who led that either, and I have no idea what she said to me, but she had a box of Kleenex. And I listened to her, and she listened to me, and I cried. And I knew that she understood. I knew that she had been where I was, and I was amazed, because she didn't look miserable. She did not look broken. She did not look as if her life was in pieces at her feet. And I see today that there was God's grace in that, because I saw that she had a solution, and I wanted what she had. I wanted to be okay again. And I realized today that being okay again was not what I wanted. I wanted to be something I had never been before. And I came to believe that it could happen if I did what you people told me to do, because you were okay. And I decided to do what you people told me to do, which had to have been a first in my life, because I always had the answers myself up until that point. So I started going to a lot of meetings, and I got a sponsor about 3 weeks after I started going to meetings. God gave her to me. She is not the person I would have chosen, but she was perfect because she was committed to the steps. She knew where the solution was. She knew that healing was in the working of the steps. The first thing she told me to read was the Big Book. And I did it. She told me to use the telephone every day, and I did it. I hated it, but I did it. She told me to go to a lot of meetings, and I did. And she told me to pray. And my first thought when she told me to pray was, well, I could not and tell her I did. She's not going to know, because I didn't believe in God. But I knew that if I did that, I was not going to get this thing. So I prayed. I think it was a gift. Today, I think it was a gift that I didn't have a relationship with God, because I didn't have anything that I had to clear out of the way before I could just start doing this deal that you tell me to do. And so I started praying, and it told me how right there in the steps, and it was easy, and I could do that. And when I did that, I started to see some little results in my life. I began to see some things begin to change a little bit in me. And I worked those steps. I'll never forget when I did my third step with her, she looked at me and she said, "You have a new employer." And I thought, wow, she is so, boy, that was good. It really got me. And I thought it was hers, and I realized now it was right out of the Big Book. But, and that's the great thing about this, you know, nothing that I say, nothing that you say is anything that we made up ourselves. We've just been given it from somebody else who was given it from somebody else. It just gets passed down and passed down. And so we have the gift of learning from so many people every day that we're in these rooms. So I worked those steps. I did that inventory. I was really eager. I was one of those real sick folks who was really eager to do my inventory, because I believed at that point that the inventory was going to make me well, that it was going to do what you said it would do, which is clear away the debris of my past. And I wasn't going to have to carry with me all the stuff that I had done to mess up my life up until that point. And I was eager to do it. And I remember that up until that point, my sponsor had been having me call her every day. I got up every morning and called her before she went to work and before I went to work. And when I left from doing my fifth step with her, she said to me, "Now that you're this far along, you don't have to call me every day anymore." And I thought, oh my God, she's heard my fifth step. Now she doesn't want me to call her. But I realize now that she was just cutting me loose a little bit so that I could find out that the solution didn't lie in her. The solution was in the steps and in the program and in the rooms and in your people. And that I could tap into the solution anywhere, anytime. I worked the steps, and I really did begin to change. And I can't tell you when it happened, but somewhere in those first 5 or 6 months, I became, I started the process of becoming a different person. I started to become the person I had always wanted to be, and didn't know how to be, and didn't think I was capable of being. But I began to change, and it was because I worked those steps. When I was in recovery about a year, my sponsor said, "Well, it's time for you to start asking God to put somebody in your life for you to help. Ask God to put somebody in front of you who needs your help." And I knew what she meant. She meant I was going to have to start sponsoring somebody. So I did that. I asked God to place somebody in front of me. My husband's sponsor tells him that the sicker we are, the more people we need to sponsor. And God knew I was real sick, because God has blessed me with a lot of people to sponsor. And within that first month after I started asking God to place somebody in front of me, God placed two really sick folks in front of me for me to sponsor. And I began to sponsor people, and I learned that there, for me, there's more growth in passing it on than there ever was in just working the steps for myself. And I worked those steps every time I worked it with somebody new, and I learned something else, and my faith got stronger, and my recovery got stronger. And I got just a little bit healthier. And our relationship, my relationship with Mike, got a little bit healthier all the time. And we began to see that there was a different way of life than the way we had been living. But I still had this wall. I didn't want you to get too close to me, because you might find out that no matter how well I shared in a meeting, no matter what pearls of wisdom I had stolen from somebody else that I was now repeating as mine, if you got too close to me, you might find out what I was really like inside. Because although I was beginning to change, I was just beginning to change. And so that wall was still up there. And what happened as a result of sponsoring these women is that wall had to come down. I had to let that wall come down in order for me to be able to pass on what I had to these other women who wanted to recover. And God kept sending them to me. And little by little, piece by piece, I took that wall down. And I began to let those women into my life. And I began to learn from them how to love and how to allow them to love me. And I'm grateful that that happened. Because as you heard last night, if you were here for Mike's talk, 2.5 years into recovery, his depression came back, and it was really the first time we realized that he had depression, and it took a while for us to figure out what was happening. And in the meantime, things in our home became very difficult, and his depression looked a lot like the drinking had looked, in terms of how we interacted, the things that were going on between us. And it was very painful. And there were times when I didn't want to go to meetings because I thought, to heck with this. You know, where's God in all this? Why is this getting worse? We had 2.5 great years. What's this? And I was angry. And I hated being in meetings where I heard people talk about how wonderful their life was. Because mine wasn't wonderful anymore. But I had to keep going to meetings. Because those women that I sponsored were there. And they were counting on me. And I just had to keep doing this thing. Because they trusted me. So I kept going. And they circled around me and held me up through that time. I could not have survived that time without those women. And we got through it, and things were good. And that time of walking through that problem, dealing with life on life's terms, which I'd never been able to do before, with the help of this program, strengthened my faith in a way that nothing else could have done. And my faith today really is the center of my life. And I owe that to the fact that bad things happen to me even in recovery. And I understand today that being in recovery, working in Great Recovery Program, is not going to mean that life doesn't keep happening to me. The last year and a half has been difficult in my life. I've lost some people. I lost a very dear friend of mine. She'd been a friend for 25 years. She worked at that first newspaper that I walked into back in Florida. And she followed me into Al-Anon about 5-6 years ago. And was a good member of Al-Anon, did a lot of service work. And she died of cancer. It was hard to lose her. In August of this past year, one of those first two women that I sponsored had a tragic accident, and she died from brain damage. And it was hard to lose her. She'd had such a powerful spiritual awakening that any room she was in felt her spirit. She was a powerful woman in Al-Anon. And I was privileged to get to be a part of that. That's the kind of thing that this program gives us. If we just keep doing the deal. And I lost her, but all those women that we were close to, stuck together, and walked through it together. And while we're sad to have lost her, more than that, we are grateful for having had her. A year and a half ago, well, I'm going to tell you about my sister. One of the things that was really important to me as I was working my steps was to try to make amends to my sister for trying to run her life, because I did that for a long time. She was my younger sister, and she was disabled. She was in a wheelchair. When we were little kids, she wore braces on her legs, and about 10 years ago, she finally needed to start using a wheelchair on a regular basis. And I spent so much of her life, you know, doing that Al-Anon thing. If you just do this, if you do that, because I knew what she needed to do. I knew how to make her life easier. And the result was that, you know, while I've got this wall up that I was telling you about a while ago, she was building one on the other side to keep me out. So we really had a nice big wall between us. And what I wanted more than anything in the world was to tear that wall down. And so I wanted to make amends to her. And although we had a good and friendly relationship, we didn't have the kind of relationship where you could talk openly and intimately about things. If anything, her wall was even higher than mine. And I realize today that her wall was built not only of the alcoholism that we grew up in, but of it was built of the pain that came with her disability as well. So when it came time to make amends to her, I talked to my sponsor because I knew that my sister would not be very receptive to having me sit down and talk to her about these things. In fact, the one time I tried to talk to her about being in Al-Anon, I sat down with her at lunch one day and I said, you know, I've been meaning to tell you, I've been going to Al-Anon for about 5 years now, and it's really been wonderful, and I'm wondering if you've ever felt that you were affected by growing up in an alcoholic family. And her response was to say, nothing at all. I might as well not have said a word. So that's the kind of relationship that I was dealing with in this business of wanting to make amends to her. And I knew that she would not be receptive to a conversation. So I wrote her a letter after having talked with my sponsor and told her the things that I felt I needed to make amends for. And I told her at the beginning of the letter, that's what I was going to do. And I said, if you want to throw this away without reading it, go right ahead. It won't hurt my feelings. I don't ever expect you to say anything, but you don't have to respond to this or anything. I just need to do this because of Al-Anon. So I wrote her the letter, and I made amends, mostly for trying to run her life, and told her I was going to try to stop doing that, and sent her the letter. And I was telling Virginia about it sometime after that, and I said, but she didn't respond. And Virginia said, yet. And I looked at Virginia and thought, yeah, well, you don't know my sister. And the truth is she did respond, but she responded by changing her behavior with me. She began to ask for my help. That doesn't sound like much, but it was huge to me that she reached the place where she trusted me enough that she could ask me to help her. We did a lot of things together that we would have not been able to do before because she was able to accept my help. And I really did have to struggle to let go of her because I watched her health deteriorate. I watched her get weaker. And in September of 2000, she was having a lot of problems. She thought she was having problems with allergy, and she finally let me take her to the doctor She asked me if I would take her to the doctor, and I took her to the doctor, and she went back, and when she finished with the doctor, she came out in 5 minutes. And she said, I just told the doctor I had some allergies, and the doctor gave me some allergy medicine. And it was, it took every bit of Al-Anon that I had to nod my head and push her chair out to the car and help her into the car and take her to work. Because what I wanted to say was, no. You need to go back into that doctor and tell that doctor this and tell that doctor that and ask this doctor. I knew what she needed to do. But I also knew that I had made a commitment to her to let her live her life her way. About 6 weeks later, on the day that she and I were supposed to leave for our annual sister's vacation, we were going to Disney World, she died in her sleep. She was not processing her oxygen properly anymore, and she died in her sleep from carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide poisoning. And it was unexpected, obviously. And the power of recovery is this. I did not blame God. In fact, I saw God's hand in everything that went on. I knew that she had been given an easy death after having lived a terribly hard life, and I saw the gift in that. I didn't blame myself, because I could have said, I knew I should have talked to that doctor. I should have done this. I didn't do that. I knew that I had done exactly what I was supposed to do, which was allow her the dignity of living and dying as she chose to. I believe she knew that death was imminent, and she chose not to do anything about it. The other gift in it was that at that time, Mike and I were allowed to walk through a death in the family with a degree of grace and love that we had never experienced before. When my mother died, he was not able to be there for me. I would not have been able to let him be there for me, but he was there for me through this. And it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me in my life, and he was there. And we owe that to this program. And I call it this program. My first sponsor would tell me, you know, it's not their program and our program. It's not their steps and our steps. It's the program and the steps. So I look at that. I look at the fact that I could lose my sister and be okay and know that God had a hand in it. And to me, that is just a reflection of what a miracle God has worked in my life. I am a miracle today. And what I will tell you is, there is a miracle out there for everyone in this room. If you haven't found your miracle yet, hang around. You will. Because this is a program of miracles. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to keep coming back, and I hope you will too. Thank you.
believe.